Okay, Martin's going to speak for a little while tonight. There'll be a time for question and answers afterwards. Please help yourself. Keep on going. I just want to read out a few words of biography, which Martin's like kindly written himself. Okay, so this is Martin blowing his own trumpet, okay? Martin Glinicky is a 52-year-old army officer with over 30 years' experience, specialising in ammunition and explosives. He is a bomb disposal operator and has served in operations in Northern Ireland, Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq and Afghanistan. He is currently serving in Bicester, where he is responsible for logistics policy in the safe and secure storage of ammunition and explosives in UK defence depots. Martin has been married to Susan for over 27 years, and his two sons Alex, age 24, and Chris, age 23. He is proud of his Yorkshire heritage, along with his wife, and support Sheffield Wednesday and Yorkshire County and Yorkshire County Cricket Club. He is a keen athlete, though age and long-term wear prevent him from competing these days. He is a chartered engineer, although read theology at Queen's University Belfast as a mature student and part-time between 2003 and 2008. He is currently a DPhil candidate at Oxford University, researching a Christian response to discrimination in asymmetrical war. Any idea what that means?
No.
None whatsoever. So find out right now. He is in his penultimate year of 6 years. Martin came to faith in his early 30s, was not selected for ordination training in 2009, and would consider himself to be a Jesus freak. That's encouraging. Now, Martin, I first met you probably about 10, 11 years ago in Wandsworth in South London, and it's been great to know you since then, and thank you very much for coming this evening to talk to us. I think Martin's going to speak for about maybe 35, 40 minutes, something like that, and then plenty of time for questions afterwards. So, Martin, over to you.
Thank you.
Shall we say a warm welcome to Martin?
So the measure of the quality of what I say will be the response at the end. If it's like that, that would be great. Can I just confirm that people in the far corner can hear me okay? Anyone forward of the gentleman with the red top on, turn your hearing aid up. Okay, because everybody at the back can hear me. I know that there are a couple of people who are not part of the Passion for Life presentation. Forgive me if this is not of any interest to you. Just enjoy the food. It'd be great. Gentlemen, there's my biography, and I thought what I'd try and do is focus on the theme of Passion for Life and try and give some idea of what it's like to be a serving soldier who became a Christian whilst I was in the armed forces and had those challenges, therefore, of being involved with taking the life of other people and a potentially pacifist role that many Christians would think that we should portray. And I'll discuss some of that a little bit later on. But I want to set a scene, first of all, about where I came from, to give an idea of... really, firstly, if you're not a Christian, that God calls and called anyone. And secondly, that it might all sound nice and enjoyable and I live in a nice quarter. But I didn't start off that way. In fact, I was the sixth child of a Polish immigrant. And my father came across the end of the Second World War, having been forced labour for about 5 years of the Second World War. And he escaped in Paris in 1944 and then moved with the 2nd Polish Corps, which was part of the 4th Army, which was famous for the North Africa campaign. And the 4th Army then went into Sicily and Salerno into Italy, and the war was over. The reason I introduced that story is I want to sell a view of Great Britain as a truly superb nation. And we might criticise ourselves every now and again, but be under no illusions that if people are prepared to fight and die for something, it's got to be something worthwhile and good. Mm. And you have about 250,000 sailors, soldiers and airmen who are still prepared to die for this country. And my point is this, is that when my father came across to the UK in 1945, Britain, although victorious, was almost on its knees. Industrially, the nation had been bombed almost to oblivion, Food was scarce, if not absolutely torturous to get hold of. But the people of this nation still welcomed my alien father and gave him a chance. And what happened to the Poles is they all went to a place called Godalming in Surrey in a concentration camp. And they were given the opportunity over 2 years to either repatriate or to stay in the UK. And my father was given a job as a steel worker in Sheffield, married my English mother, and the rest is, as they say, history. He's dead now, and so is my mother. But it sets the scene of where I came from. So I came from a hard working class area, right in the centre of Sheffield, in the industrial heartland of steelmaking. And I grew up as a thing. I was fighting at school, I was fighting when I was an adolescent, and I was fighting as a young man. However, I went to a school of 1,700 people, and the sixth form was about 16 people all told. So it gives you an idea of the type of school that I was in. But I was gifted with an ability somehow to just do some academia, just to learn. And I came out with some good O levels and some good A levels. And I remember a teacher once saying to me, "Martin, you want to go to university?" And I said, "There is no way I am wasting the best years of my life between 18 and 21 going to university." Well, I did, thankfully. I had a great time at university. But again, I was a thing. And it goes back to where I am now as a Christian. Because I kept on... I was a gang fighter. And I enjoyed it. And I got a buzz from it. And I did things that young men from industrial might cities did, which was too much fornication, too much having a good time. But there was something inside me which said, this is not right. And the only two things that I wanted to do when I left or towards the end of my university time was to teach or to join the army. And the reason I wanted to teach was because I looked back and thought, education had been my route out of the hard industrial working class of Sheffield, undoubtedly. And I wanted to put something back, and my teachers gave me a chance. And I have an enormous amount of respect for our teachers, therefore. But it was a time in the mid-70s when the teachers were always on strike. And it put me off a bit. And the army, therefore, looked exciting. And I joined the army. And I joined the army of the Cold War era. So I went to Germany, and the planning was all about a great war of masses and hordes of Russians coming across the inner German border, and the NATO countries would fight them back, and then there'd be a great big nuclear war, an event, and then hopefully all home for tea and medals. That was the plan. Thankfully, we never went to nuclear war, and that's great. But in many ways, perhaps the fall of the Berlin Wall has made the world slightly less safe or less secure. And that's a debate. But for me, I joined the army really because I saw in Andrew's home nation a very exciting event. I saw people defusing bombs on the streets of Northern Ireland. And I felt that was a challenging and rewarding opportunity. And as a young person, I make no bones about it, it looked exciting. And I thought, that's better than being a pilot. That'll get attraction. That'll get women. It'll be fantastic. So we have to be realistic about this, you know, when we're young, and I was saying that when that's hard, that's soft, well, that's where I was as a young boy. And I joined the army, and I joined and trained as an ammunition technical officer. But before then, you have to do a whole heap of grounding in ammunition and explosives. And that's what I did. And so I went to Northern Ireland for my first tour of operations, which was in South Armagh. At the time, a pretty hideous place to be if you were English, and certainly if you were a soldier, there were people who were clearly trying to kill you. And I, two reflections of that sort of talk. Firstly, it was the first time I was blown up and got away with it. And what we had to do was go to a particular job which was a running van bomb. And in simple terms, an enormous amount of explosives in a van parked outside a police station in a village called Market Hill in South Armagh. It's a beautiful police station. And the timer was running down, and the action for a bomb disposal team which I led was that we would drive some vans as close as possible to the bomb, we would deploy a remote robot to drive down the road and deploy an explosive to try and shatter the bomb, the van bomb itself, before it functioned and blew the whole place up. And it had been designed, there was a particular type of equipment that could do that, if you could get to the bomb on time. So we dashed out of our camp, drove with blue lights in our vehicles, which were all Macrolon covered, so some protection. And it was all about procedure. So we crossed the vehicles so they went into a T, so that as we looked down the road at this bomb, if something happened, we were covered by the vehicle. Anyway, we deployed the vehicle. I had all my team undercover inside the vehicles, and the bomb went down, functioned underneath this large car bomb, so the intention was to try and split it before it all blew up, but there was an enormous bang. And apart from me being blown up and having a few scratches around, my number two, who was my guide and mentor, said, "Was that the pawpaw, which was this little device, sir?" To which I said, "No, I think it was a bit bigger than that," as the whole of Mark Hill came tumbling down on me. The great story from it, however, was that when it came to compensation, Market Hill was a farm town. And it was Farmer's Day, and therefore they were selling sheep in sheep pens. And the centre of Market Hill had a number of sheep pens, about 45. Now the claims for dead sheep that came to the would have meant that the sheep were five high. It was a great story. I then returned to Northern Ireland for a 2-year tour, and I lived in Armagh with my wife and family. An interesting place to live, because we had to therefore be very careful about our own personal security. My youngest son was born there, Christopher, in the hostel in Craigavon, and my eldest son had been born a year and 5 months earlier here at John Ratcliffe in Oxford, and clearly on the birth certificate was my occupation, army officer, and my wife's occupation, banker. In Northern Ireland, I'd suddenly become a chartered accountant, and my wife was a banker. So in 15 months I'd learnt to be an accountant, and then been chartered in that same vicinity. But I know that we have a curate that worked for an organisation as a civil servant, who's had to keep himself very secretive as well. So I've lived a life, in my early days, whereby I couldn't come home in uniform. I carried a gun into my bed at night, and I had young children to live with. And in a way, it takes a little bit of time to get used to that, but used to it you do. And all the police officers and other soldiers in Northern Ireland at that time had to live in that sort of environment. Great story. I then went to Bosnia and Kosovo and did a similar sort of thing, defusing bombs and making sure that the British ammunition and explosives were all safe and secure for our own soldiers to fight in those wars. I remember that Bosnia and Kosovo were a very different type of war. Ethnic cleansing had been going on, dreadful sight. To see houses being burnt out and to witness children having burnt out of their house and schools, for young soldiers as well as me, is a very, very desperate situation. And it's a position whereby you had to look at your young, because there were men and women at this time, and try and give them the confidence that what they're seeing is horrific, but that we can do something about it. And there's nothing pleasant in war, and perhaps that's why we have such a sort of shipyard humour, to try and overcome some of those challenges at times. But we're looking back on the Balkans. I'd like to think that the United Nations and the coalition forces actually did a good job there, and that we don't read too much about tyranny in the Balkans, more of movement of migrants, and that's a good thing, I think. I then went back to Northern Ireland and worked for a particular special forces organisation, and this is where it was probably the most challenging, rewarding and fulfilling role I've ever done in the armed forces. And it'll be no surprise to people that intelligence rules everything. And the reason I think that we brought Northern Ireland to the Good Friday Agreement and to some form of peace compared to what it was in the 70s, 80s and early 90s was by the will of the people, but also by very good intelligence. And I was a technical intelligence officer, and that's a cover story for me going into some pretty horrible places and defusing bombs without the perpetrators knowing that I defused them. And that's a bit of a challenge, because if you think about an improvised bomb made by a terrorist, there are no patents for it. It's not like taking your car to the garage and knowing where components will be and how you can change them if they're wrong. So you have to work out how that device that's been set by a terrorist is going to function. And you have to do it in the dark. And you have to do it with some trepidation. But equally, you have to do it because some other soldier has been overlooking that area, probably for days. Or another soldier has gone undercover, or a police officer, to find out what's happening. And so you've got to save that source of information. And if need be, risk your own life to save that source of information. Now, when you've got a young family, and boys are 5 and 6 at the time, in many ways it makes you think. And this is really where I started to think about what the meaning of life was, because I never really darkened a church's door until that sort of period. I'd been a classic Church of England goer. My parents had gone to church at Christmas and Easter and for weddings and funerals, and I was likewise. But I came to a conclusion that there must be something in life which says what's good and what's bad, what is morally right and what is morally wrong, and what actually is the meaning of life. What is the purpose of what we do? Is life all about just having a bloody great time? Or is there something more to life? And actually, is there a real passion for life? Is there something that each one of us makes us tick? Do we all look at ourselves and say, that fella or that lady does something which I admire, but actually, I do something as well that is admirable to others, even though we may not think it at the time. So while I still would argue that I've had a tremendously fulfilling opportunity as a bomb disposal officer and been challenged enormously, and I've, you know, if I can try and be humble, I was awarded a gallantry medal for some of the activities that I've done in bomb disposal. My point now, looking back on all of those events, on any bomb disposal activity that I've done subsequently in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that I was gifted with an ability which I then did. And I think each one of us is gifted with talents, and it is our responsibility to utilise those talents and fulfil them. And my argument would be to anyone that if you are given a great talent and that you don't use it, you are wasting some of God's purpose for you. And I beg of you to motivate yourself and drive yourself further forward. So I came to faith based on what I saw in my military career. Some of the atrocities in the Balkans in particular, some of the hatred of people in Northern Ireland, and some of the total abhorrence of people in the Middle East. Carnage and murder. It is something that we've seen unlimited times on the streets of the United Kingdom. But until you actually witness it close hand and frequently, you perhaps don't think and ponder as I do just how great a nation Great Britain is. And that our forefathers, whether they be an immigrant like my own father, or the historic British forefathers, or every single migrant that's come across this country since, whether they be from West Indies, Africa, or more recently from Pakistan, Bangladesh and India, and the Far East, those people are what make the community as great as it is. And I think it's really, really very important. What I also want to share with you is this. A passion for faith means it's not going to be easy. And actually, my army career was much easier as a non-Christian. Because coming to faith brings with it certain internal responsibilities in your heart. So I have become better because I tithe. When I ask the question, who cares? I say to myself, I care. Who cares about the poor? I care about the poor. I genuinely care about the poor. Who cares about someone on the street who sat at the side of the road begging? I care. I personally choose not to give them any money. I choose to give them a sandwich, or I give my money to charity. But it's not for me to say what anybody else should do. The point is, faith in God has made me care. Faith in God has given me a purpose. Faith in God has given me what I didn't realise before was a real empowering love for my own wife. I never realised just how much I love my wife, or how you could love your own wife, until I had a faith in God. Because it's a case of my own failings in my earlier life have been totally forgiven. I am totally redeemed. I can look back and speak to people like yourselves who I've never met before apart from Andrew and say, this is who I am. And I can be open and honest and have no fear, no shame, disappointment in myself, but no shame and no fear. And coming to faith has brought some challenges. When asked the question, why is a very healthy soldier racing and running and competing at a reasonable level, did I have to suffer from glaucoma at the age of 44? Why me? And I kept myself healthy and fit. Why did I get early onset glaucoma? What faith does is it says, why not? Why should it be Andrew? Or his curate? Or anyone else here? Why shouldn't it be me? When I was accused of fraud by an exchange officer in Australia, which I clearly hadn't done because I'm still serving, and I had a 6-month investigation into potential fraud, which at the end of that 6 months found no evidence because there was none. I asked the question, why me? Why would someone detest me so much as to accuse me of fraud? And the reason was that that group of people didn't like the fact that I was a Christian and the values that came with them. So faith, for me, has been the encompassing part of my life. And as I come to the end of my military career, I'll do one more tour, probably in Iraq, in support of the events that are occurring in northern Iraq and northern Syria. But thankfully, it'll be a very much supportive role, because glaucoma and diffusing bones with your hands don't really go well together. No matter how big your glasses are, you can't see around the sides of you. So thankfully, I'll be given much more of a supporting role. And my final thoughts really are to summarise, and I'll open up for any questions. And if you've got no questions, I'll just keep talking for a bit longer. Is that I've had, I suppose, the greatest and unnerving disappointment in my life was to feel that I was called to ordination to such an extent that I went through the process to convince myself I read theology at Queen's University part-time to get a better understanding of what faith meant. I went through the process of selection for ordination and wasn't selected. Now, I've grown in my own faith journey into what we would probably describe as an Anglo-Catholic tradition. So my own belief, as I've worked through my own faith seeking understanding, is in real presence. So for those that aren't Christians, don't worry about this, it's just technical jargon, mumbo jumbo. And for those of you who are evangelical, this will challenge you. But my own view is that I've moved into that part of Christian faith. But I'm comfortable with all the sort of central pillars of faith, and I can be in community with all those people that believe in the triune God, Christology, Christ, Son of God. But in not being selective for ordination training and believe that God called me, I had to say to myself, why did I think and believe that? And that was probably the biggest challenge in my own spiritual journey. To think that I was called to ordination and not to be selective. And I had to be very careful, because I had suggested to the selection board that I was of an Anglo-Catholic tradition. And I think, as a result of that experience, I've become a better soldier. More forgiving, more understanding when things go wrong. And so as I look at the pepper pot of my own journey, in my initial start in life as a complete horror, to a marriage, to a beautiful wife and two great sons, to a adventurous and appealing and fulfilling career in the armed forces, to have met great people and had opportunities to meet people like yourself, it's been a great time. But I've actually probably learnt most from the times when it's been really difficult, like when people that you trust charge you with fraud or similar sort of thing, or charge you with being thoughtless because you have a belief that's different to the modern secular society. And I'm certainly a better person for that. And I've just got one final story which I want to share. Starts off with a story about Market Hill. And a police officer that I served with, who was the police officer at my group of vehicles on that bomb disposal task, I sent him back from where I was at the incident control point to a point about another 250 metres away and behind a wall. And he wasn't injured. It was the best decision I ever made. But the funniest story is that he then put a sign up, because the original sign of Market Hill had fallen down. So he put a sign up, the original sign, got some white paint and painted out Market. And it's now just called Hill. There's no longer any market there. I blew it up. Gentlemen, I hope that's been of interest. I hope that in sharing my own bit of testimony, my own experience as a bomb disposal officer, and particularly for those that have no faith or have just come for interest, I, like some of you, have fluctuated. I've asked all sorts of questions. But I think the one thing that convinces me that we have an omnipotent, transcendent God is the balance between the creative order of the earth and its beauty, and that if you were going to suggest that you had created the earth, the heavens and everything in it, I can't, as a chartered engineer, now reading a DPhil in philosophy, so a scientist and a philosopher, I can't think of a more trusted way to show to humanity that there is a creative order and a creator and a loving God than to send one man at one time in the history of humanity to give a perfect sacrifice having presented the only way to be a perfect sacrifice through the Old Testament readings, is to be totally and utterly without sin. And so I think whoever we are, Christian or not, Muslim or not, of any faith or no faith, we are forgiven. We are redeemed, and every one of us should be comfortable in that. I hope that's been of interest. Thank you very much indeed for your time.